Beethoven, Shostakovich, and Marsh Program Notes. Written by Jeff Wall and read by Sasha Gorbaso. Dmitri Shostakovich, 1906 to 1975, Chamber Symphony in C minor, Opus 110A, orchestrated by Rudolf Barschai, after String Quartet No. 8. The publication in 1979 of Testimony, the allegedly dictated memoirs of the late Dmitri Shostakovich, landed like a bombshell among musical academics. Instead of the familiar Western portrait of the dour, ideologically correct Soviet artist, who had occasionally appeared in cultural exchange tours, spouting communist orthodoxy, the book presented the composer as a human being, angry and bitter, but with a wickedly cynical wit, who in fact expressed political dissonance in his music, while maintaining a facade of compliance with the regime. Some, mostly Western musicologists, rejected Testimony as a hoax, a combination of existing documents and uncorroborated remarks presented as direct quotation to boost sales. Others, mostly Russian, defended it as a generally accurate portrayal of the composer and his privately expressed views, whatever its provenance. Salvos and broadsides in the so-called Shostakovich Wars continued into the 21st century. This much is certain: the attention that Testimony focused on Shostakovich made him more popular than ever before. The book was even made into a movie with Ben Kingsley as the composer. The revisionist view was given credence after the USSR's collapse declassified documents and enabled the composer's friends to speak openly. It also permitted music portrayed in the West as empty bombast and rhetoric to acquire new meaning as satire and sarcasm, to be perceived as art for the oppressed rather than mere political propaganda. Paradoxically, that music remains the same, irrespective of Shostakovich's intent. And what is conveyed can greatly depend on which Shostakovich its interpreters wish to present. The Chamber Symphony Opus 110A is a composer-sanctioned arrangement for string orchestra of Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 8, made by the violist-conductor Rudolf Barschai in 1967. An earlier transcription for strings and timpani by Alexander Stasiewicz was evidently unsatisfactory. The quartet was composed in Dresden over just 3 days in July 1960, where Shostakovich was to write the soundtrack for a film about the World War II bombing of the city. In early September, the Soviet newspaper Izvestia quoted him, "The terrors of the bombardment, which we heard about in the words of the victims, suggested the themes of my 8th quartet. I found myself under the influence of the scenes being filmed, reproducing the way it used to be. I am dedicating it to the victims of war and fascism." But in a letter of July 19, 1960, to his friend Isaac Glickman, not published until 1993, Shostakovich had written, "As hard as I tried to rough out the film scores, which I am supposed to be doing, I still haven't managed to get anywhere. Instead, I wrote this ideologically flawed quartet, which is of no use to anyone. I started thinking that if someday I die, no one is likely to write a work in memory of me, so I'd better write one myself." The title page could carry the dedication, "To the memory of the composer of this quartet." Testimony, 1979, adds, "Later, all the misery was put down to the war, as though it was only during the war that people were tortured and killed. The 8th Quartet was also assigned to the Department of Exposing Fascism." You have to be blind and deaf to do that, because everything in the quartet is as clear as a primer. I quote Lady Macbeth, the opera for which Shostakovich was publicly condemned and persecuted in 1936, the 1st and 5th Symphonies. What does fascism have to do with these? The 8th is an autobiographical quartet. It quotes a song known to all Russians, "Tormented by Lack of Freedom," which Shostakovich set in his 1935 film score, The Girlfriends. And there is also the Jewish theme from the Piano Trio No. 2 in this quartet. Jewish folk music is as close to my ideas of what music should be. There should always be two layers in music. Jews were tormented for so long that they learned to hide their despair. They expressed despair in dance music. One friend's unsubstantiated account claims that Shostakovich had intended to make this autobiographical quartet his last work by committing suicide, an event forestalled by the friend's confiscation of the composer's sleeping pills. Glickman confirms that Shostakovich was in a state of emotional turmoil in late June 1960, weeping and quite hysterical. The cause of the composer's anguish was his recent commitment to join the Communist Party, something he had steadfastly refused to do, and an act which had defied complete explanation. To his wife, he would only say without elaboration that it was due to blackmail. It was this decision, which placed Shostakovich in the forefront of official Soviet cultural functions, that more than anything else condemned him as a loyal communist flunky in the eyes of Western observers. The Quartet Symphony's 5 movements are played without pause. Its autobiographical nature is established from the first 4 unaccompanied bass notes, D, S, C, H, the musical monogram of D. Shostakovich, the German transliteration of his name. In German musical theory, E flat is called S, and B natural is H. After all 4 voices have played this figure, which permeates the whole work, the 2 violin sections present the opening of the First Symphony, 1926, his first success, but in a lugubrious tempo. It is the first in a generally chronological series of quotations of the composer's works, following a chromatic violin solo, the 5th Symphony, with which he atoned in 1937 for the reviled Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, is recalled over a long bass drone. While major events in Shostakovich's life provide a framework for understanding his piece, its significance extends beyond the personal. A dedication to the victims of state-sponsored terror, among whom the composer counted himself, would seem more appropriate in light of his above remarks than the official dedication to the victims of fascism and war. The second movement erupts with a ferocious and frightening theme, accompanied by short explosive chords, like gunshots. DSCH is soon ensnared in it. Shostakovich endured Nazi shelling in Leningrad, but the absence of a quote from his Leningrad Symphony, No. 7, suggests the Stalinist purges are meant, in which many thousands perished from a bullet to the head. Out of this arises the Jewish theme from Piano Trio No. 2, 1944, written just as the first Nazi extermination camps were discovered by Russian troops and dedicated to Shostakovich's best friend, rumored murdered by the secret police, NKVD. Victims, all. In the Allegretto, DSCH dances a delicately spooky waltz, perhaps with death. In 1949, his initial refusal to travel to the Cultural and Peace Congress in the United States resulted in a phone call from Stalin. From testimony, "All I thought about was how much longer do I have to live?" The trio contains the theme of the First Cello Concerto, 1959, penned at the time of the repression of Boris Pasternak, whose Dr. Zhivago had just been awarded the Nobel Prize. The gruff 3-note figure that signals the start of the 4th movement originated in a film score, where it represented the gunfire of executions. It had also been interpreted, by his son Maxim, as the dreaded knock on the door signifying the nocturnal arrival of the NKVD, which Shostakovich heard many times on apartment doors not his own. A suggestion of the Desire chant from the Catholic Requiem Mass is heard. The rapping is repeated, and hushed first violins play the revolutionary song, "Tormented by lack of freedom, you are honored by a glorious death," over an immobile bass. The cello solo quotes an aria from Lady Macbeth, in which the heroine discovers her lover's betrayal. After one last Desire reference, Shostakovich concludes the work with the funeral rite of a slow fugue on DSCH. A muted reinstatement of the first movement's opening might be a symbolic gravestone. "This is myself," he told the Borodin Quartet when they played it for him. This account and several others describe the tears its performance would evoke from him. Ludwig van Beethoven, 1770 to 1827. Symphony No. 7 in A major, Opus 92. A symphony as significant and exciting as Beethoven's 7th deserves to have a great story behind it, Unfortunately, in this case, it hasn't. But the power of the music acting on the romantic spirit could not be denied. And so, poetic effusion in her billowing bloomers was wafted aloft on wings of purple prose. All tumult, all yearning and storming of the heart becomes here the blissful insolence of joy, which snatches us away with bacchanalian might and bears us through the roomy space of nature, through all the streams and seas of life, shouting in glad self-consciousness as we tread throughout the universe the daring measures of the human sphere dance. This symphony is the apotheosis of dance herself. This excerpt from Richard Wagner's Artwork of the Future is still frequently quoted in program notes today, and tonight, because the problem alluded to above still exists. In the autumn of 1911, Beethoven, far from shouting in glad self-consciousness, was concerned with two things, inflation and his health. Due to the losses of the Napoleonic Wars, in March, the Austrian government had devalued the florin by 80%. Beethoven's annuity, a contract financed by three princes, which had been made to ensure he would remain in Vienna, lost purchasing power, and for years he was placed in the awkward position of having to bargain with royalty to honor the spirit of their agreement. As well, he was beset by various ailments in addition to his growing deafness. As we know now, he was suffering from lead poisoning. And in August 1811, he headed to the spa at Teplitz to take the cure. The earliest sketches for the Seventh Symphony date from about this time. In fact, he planned a series of three symphonies, concurrently setting down themes for the Eighth and even what would much later become the Ninth, and they reflect nothing of these trying circumstances. Beethoven returned from Teplitz refreshed, if not cured, and had completed the Seventh by May of 1812. But while his sketches survive, he left not a word about its creation. Nevertheless, a letter to an unidentified woman, the so-called immortal beloved, written in July 1812, shows Beethoven in an agony over the question of marriage, or at least cohabitation, and it is tempting to conjecture that this relationship was ripening during the composition of this symphony. Now that would make a great story. The lady in question was evidently married already, and Beethoven unhappily decided to break off the affair, effectively ending his hope of finding a wife. After completing the Eighth Symphony, already well underway, he apparently lapsed into a depression, and in 1813 he composed virtually nothing. 1813 was the year when the Seventh Symphony made its long-delayed debut, however, in December. Previous attempts had fallen through. If Beethoven's spurt of symphonic activity had been launched by thoughts of pecuniary relief, they foundered on the same financial rock as his annuity. Concerts were a hard sell in hard times, except for charitable events. Thus, it was at a benefit for widows and orphans of fallen soldiers on a program with his topical Wellington's Victory, featuring a mechanical orchestra manufactured by the inventor of the metronome, Maltzel, that the Seventh was premiered. Many prominent musicians were in the orchestra, including the violinist-composer-conductor Louis Spohr, who recalled Beethoven's conducting as peculiar. At a sforzando, a sudden accent, he tore his arms, previously crossed on his breast, violently apart. At a piano, soft passage, he crouched down, bending lower the softer the tone. At the crescendo, he raised himself by degrees until at the forte, he sprang up to his full height. At the rehearsals, it was obvious Beethoven could not actually hear the soft passages, for he missed a pause mark at one point and unwittingly found himself leaping when he should have been crouching. But the concert was a success, the Allegretto being encored, and another performance was scheduled to the great benefit of the cause. Superficially, the Seventh Symphony appears to be a retrenchment of classical values in view of the modernisms of the Fifth and Sixth, with their added trombones and connected movements, neither of which figure here. Yet Beethoven was still modernizing, though in a direction to which subsequent musical developments have made present-day audiences insensitive, extending the range of keys encompassed by a single symphony. While Wagner and many others have remarked on the rhythmic element of this work, understandably, for each movement is built from a reiteration of a different single rhythmic figure, the question of tonality and what other pitch centers appear in addition to the primary key of A major is central to Beethoven's thinking. The massive introduction to the first movement, unprecedented in its scope, poses the problem immediately. While the woodwinds answer each other's broad melody, the bass instruments sneak downward chromatically, until in no time, the opening A major has become F major, which in Beethoven's day was company that A major did not normally keep. String scales restore the opening key, but the bass progression is repeated, so that when a lyrical second theme appears in the oboe, it too is in F major. The lively flute figure is again in A, but F is back for the third movement. Reconciling the argument between these two antagonistic tonalities is the musical point of Beethoven's symphony. Of course, no one would care a fig about this if the music itself weren't so overwhelming in its emotional impact, which Wagner so floridly attempted to reproduce in words. The wild abandon of the finale was actually a barrier to conservative critics of the day, and Wagner's use of the term bacchanalian may be connected to a popular opinion that Beethoven was drunk when he wrote it. The encyclopedist George Grove preferred to see in it the character of the composer in his self-described unbuttoned mood. In this regard, and with respect perhaps to the somberness of the Allegretto, the following passage from a letter of Beethoven's written in early 1811 is interesting. "It was 4 o'clock before I got home this morning from a bacchanalian feast, at which I had to laugh so much that I shall have to weep correspondingly today. Boisterous joy often forces me powerfully back in upon myself again." The sketches for the Allegretto and the finale exist side by side in Beethoven's sketchbook.